Hi, everyone, and welcome to a bonus episode of Conversations from the Pale Blue Dot. I won't be interviewing any experts today, but instead I want to interact with some of your thoughts. And so I asked you to call a number and leave me a voicemail so that I could interact with your questions or comments in audio. And a lot of you did that, so I'm looking forward to responding to you. If you want to leave your own question or comment for me to respond to, you can call 413-723-0175. It'll say hit 1 to leave a message, so you hit 1, and then you just leave your message and hang up. And then I'll put it on the air here and respond to it. So the first question I'll respond to is from reader Just Fine Thanks.
Hi there, Luke. I copied as Just Fine Thanks on your blog, and I have two questions. In one of your posts, you said that you write a blog of evangelical atheism. Now, do you really mean that and that you wish and think that we would all be better off if everyone was an atheist? Or do you take the friendlier atheist route of not really caring what people's metaphysical beliefs are, so long as they have good, well-filed reasons for having those beliefs? Secondly, even if you think a successful atheistic argument is not necessary to be an atheist, what do you personally think the most compelling atheistic argument ever offered is? Or, if you don't think any atheist arguments are particularly compelling, which ones do you think give theists the most trouble in overcoming? Thank you so much, and enjoy your blog.
Cool. So, this was actually the first question to come in, and it's exactly the kind of thing that I was looking for. So, thank you, Just Fine Thanks. You provide a lot of material to talk about in those two questions. So let me try to break it into little packets. First, am I an evangelical atheist in that I'm trying to convert people? The answer is basically yes. I mean, I'm more interested in getting people to think for themselves and to help people research these issues and provide resources for them to do that and to talk about basic issues in logic and religion and ethics. So I do a lot of that, but in the end, unless somebody convinces me of a different position, I am trying to challenge people's beliefs in God and would like to eventually have them give up their beliefs in God. Now, I don't really know how much effect I'm going to have in that arena, but if I can sow some seeds of doubt, that is part of what I'm trying to do. So in that sense, I am an evangelical atheist. And the reason for that, the reason I care about other people's beliefs, is because the truth matters. It matters whether disease is caused by demons or by microorganisms. It matters if prayer does good or if it wastes time. It really matters if God has told you to do this or do that, or if you have to find your own purpose in this world. And so the truth really matters, and so I happen to think that it's the truth that there aren't any gods or ghosts or demons or a whole host of things. And so the non-existence of gods just happens to be one thing that I've decided to make my battle, and I let other people debunk ghosts and talk about why vaccines are important and, you know, all these other things that are really important battles as well. Now, you asked about friendly atheism. Am I a friendly atheist? And I want to say, whenever I use the term friendly atheism, I'm referring to something very specific in the philosophical literature. It comes from a famous 1976 paper by William Rowe called The Problem of Evil and Some Varieties of Atheism, where he distinguishes three types of positions that an atheist might take about the rationality of a theist's position. So let's say the atheist is right and God doesn't exist and the atheist has good reasons to believe so. What does that make the atheist have to say about the rationality of the theist? So unfriendly atheism would mean that no theists are rational to believe in God. Indifferent atheism would mean that the atheist doesn't take a position on whether or not theists can be rational to believe in God. And then friendly atheist would be someone who thinks that some theists, at least, are actually rational to believe in God. And I am a friendly atheist in that sense, in that I think some Christians or Muslims or whoever are rational to believe in the existence of God. And a lot of atheists don't even understand how I could think that, but if you think about issues in regular scientific disagreement, it seems like when two scientists come at an issue, and it's a really complex issue and very complicated, and there's all kinds of different kinds of evidence to consider, and there seem to be some good reasons for both sides, then it seems like we have a case where they can both be rational and come to opposite conclusions. And that's especially the case when we have very incomplete information and we're working with things that are really outside the realm of what normal stuff is. And if anything fits that bill, it's God, right? He's totally different, supposedly, than anything else, and it's really hard for us to figure out where the evidence would point. Now, I actually think that when you look at the evidence, that it points pretty conclusively that God doesn't exist, but I can see how certain believers would disagree with that. And I can even see especially how people who aren't very familiar with science or aren't very familiar with history, especially those people, might be rational to believe in God given the information that they have. For example, if you grow up in the Bible Belt in America and you don't really know of any atheist books, you go to Christian school and you read Christian books, and you read books from people like William Lane Craig that sound really smart and sound like they really provide compelling evidence for God, and you feel like you've experienced God, there are many cases when that person might be rational in the only way that it makes sense to talk about rationality, to believe in God. And yet, I'm an atheist, and I think that I have good reasons for rejecting the existence of God. So I'm a friendly atheist in that sense. But now you, Just Fine Thanks, asked for a different meaning of friendly atheism. You asked, do I not really care about what people's beliefs are as long as they have good reasons for them? And even that question is a really complicated question because there's so much to unpack here. So first of all, I do care what people's beliefs are, whether or not they have good reasons to believe in them, because, like I said, the truth matters. So it might be that a lot of atheists don't believe in God, but they don't have any good reasons for disbelief. They just, you know, don't like the idea, or they want to be in control of their own life, or, you know, they don't think about any of this stuff. They just kind of grew up atheist or whatever. Now, those people just got lucky, and they had a correct belief, but not because they had good reasons for being atheists. A better example would be a belief that has more content, like believing that vaccines work. You know, so somebody who's never looked at the science and has no idea might not have good reasons to think that vaccines save lives, but they got lucky and they have a true belief, and so that's really going to make a difference in the lives of their families and people where they make decisions. So I do care about the content of people's beliefs regardless of the reasons that they have for them. Now, as a normative and moral issue, I think it is important to promote the importance of having good reasons for your beliefs as much as possible, because if you teach people how knowledge works and how logic works and how science works, then they're more likely to be careful about how they form their beliefs, and they're more likely to end up at true beliefs. I mean, as a human race, we've spent so much time believing incredibly arrogant falsehoods. And these falsehoods have done tremendous damage to millions of real human beings who suffer either because we just stubbornly held the false beliefs, or because we just innocently accepted things that seemed like they would be true without even looking into them very well. So I think it is really important that we promote things like logic and science and just a general personal awareness of what seems to work when we try to go after knowledge, so that people can be more likely to have true beliefs, because true beliefs help us fulfill our desires, they help us fulfill other people's desires. True beliefs are really important if you want to get anything done in the real universe. Now, your second question was about, even if I don't think successful atheistic arguments are required to justify atheism, what do I think is the most compelling atheistic argument? And for a lot of people, I might have to unpack that first part. It basically just means that the theist has a burden of proof. So if you want me to believe that aliens are invading the planet and taking poor farmers up and probing them, then fine, I don't have a problem with that, but I'd like to see some evidence. I'd like to have some reason to believe that that's true. Same thing with people who claim to have psychic powers. Fine, maybe that's the way the universe works. It would be kind of less surprising than some things that we've learned from quantum mechanics. But I'd like to see some evidence for it. And quantum mechanics has produced extraordinarily precise results and lots of very good evidence, and there hasn't been very good evidence for psychic powers. So the same thing with anything. You want me to believe that the moon landings actually happened? Provide good evidence. Well, it so happens good evidence has been provided, so I believe that. Or you want me to believe in common descent and evolution by natural selection? Provide me with good evidence for that theory. There are lots of competing theories. Oh, but, well, it happens that that theory does have extraordinary evidence behind it. You want me to believe that a particular economic theory has more merit than another economic theory? Then, you know, show me the evidence, show me the logic, show me the reasoning. And so the same thing is going to happen for anything, and that includes God. So if you want me to believe in God, give me some good reasons. Now, if you give me those reasons and I say, well, I don't really think that's a good reason because X, Y, and Z, then, you know, you'll have to go back to the drawing board. So as an atheist, I don't really think that I have to disprove the existence of God. I mean, I don't have to disprove the existence of invading aliens in order to be justified in not believing in them. I can't disprove the existence of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, but I'm quite rational to not believe in a Flying Spaghetti Monster until evidence has been presented. So the burden of proof is on the person making the positive existence claim, and in this case, that's the theist, and right now I just am not persuaded by the arguments that theists have offered. Just like I'm not persuaded by the hundreds of arguments that have been offered by people who believe that the Earth is flat, and there's actually entire books with lists of arguments for that. Or I'm not persuaded by the arguments from people who think that they have psychic powers. You know, hundreds of arguments and experiences, but 100 bad arguments doesn't make one good argument. But now, as it turns out, not only do I think that theistic arguments are not very compelling, I also think that there are some compelling atheistic arguments, some positive reasons to not believe in God. Now, this didn't have to be the case. Like, it's hard for me to think of any arguments that I would have against the existence of pink unicorns. I mean, the only argument I can think of there is that we've been pretty much everywhere on the land on Earth, and that's where they would seem to be, and we haven't seen them. So that's about the best argument I could muster for that kind of thing. But I think there are lots of really great arguments against the existence of God, but most of them depend on how you define God. So if you define God as a personal creator of the universe and not assume anything about omniscience or omnipotence or whether or not he cares about people or anything like that, it would be very difficult to disprove such a God because he wouldn't have any effects in the world that we could measure. So it'd be very difficult to have an argument against such a God. But if you start defining God a bit more specifically, like, for example, saying that he's all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good, then we might start to have some arguments against the existence of that kind of God. For example, we might say that an all-good God would prevent evil if he could, and since he's all-powerful, he could, and since he's all-knowing, he would know about the evil, and so the existence of evil doesn't seem to square with the existence of an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good God. Now, it does accord quite easily with the existence of an all-knowing, all-powerful, morally indifferent God, or morally mischievous God. Evil provides no evidence against such a God. But for historical reasons, people are not very interested to believe in that kind of God, even though he fits the evidence much better than an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good God. Or, you know, all of these properties of God can often be waged against each other, so there are some reasons to think that it might be impossible that a being could be both omnipresent and all-knowing. There are some reasons to think that a being could not be both timeless and capable of thought. There are about 20 or 30 of these kinds of arguments, and I haven't spent much time on them yet, so I don't know how compelling they are. Now, if you get even more specific in your definition and say something like, God wants to reconcile himself to humanity, or something like that, incredibly specific God, then there are additional arguments that we might wage against such a God. For example, we might say, well, if he's all-powerful and he wants to reconcile himself with humanity, then he seems to be doing a very poor job of it, because there are about a billion non-believers on the planet, and then whichever religion you think is correct, there are more religionists who deny the existence of your God or gods. So that doesn't seem to fit very well with the existence of an all-powerful God who wants to reconcile himself with humanity. And then if you get incredibly specific, like the existence of the God who revealed himself in Jesus of Nazareth, I mean, then you have, you know, even more arguments that you could levy against such a God. So if you ask me what's the most compelling atheistic argument, it really depends on which God we're arguing against and how specifically you want to define him. So if you ask what's the most compelling argument against the God who reveals himself in Jesus Christ and divinely inspired every word of the necessarily inerrant scriptures, I mean, the case against such a God is pretty overwhelming. But if you want to say, what's the best argument against the existence of some kind of non-physical higher power, I mean, then all the traditional atheistic arguments are pretty much not applicable, and we have to go with either just saying, well, there's a complete lack of evidence for such a God, or we might do something like the basic argument for naturalism, which in basic form goes like this. It says, look, as a historical matter, we used to think that magic was responsible for almost everything. We thought that everything was agency, so if the crops failed, the gods were angry with us. If there's lightning coming down, the gods are angry with us. If some woman gives birth to twins, then the gods are with her, and, you know, diseases caused by demonic mischief, and everything is spirits and agents and invisible people doing things. Now, as it's turned out, and as the history and science has progressed, we found that over and over and over and over again, all those things turn out to be natural explanations. Whenever we look close enough to really get a grasp of how something works, it turns out to be just mindless natural forces that cause lightning and crop death and twins being birthed and all this kind of stuff. So over and over and over and over again, thousands and thousands of times, and not once, when we've been able to look close enough, have we found out that at the very core it turns out to actually be magic. So we're faced with a choice after several centuries of this. Are we going to bet that the next thing that we thought was magic is going to turn out to actually be magic? Or are we going to bet that it's probably going to turn out like the rest of them and have some mindless natural cause that we just don't understand at our present state of knowledge? And so the naturalist is just the person who bets on the horse that has won every single one of the million races it has run, and bets against the horse that has lost every one of the million races it has run. That's all an atheist is. So with some work, you can put that into a nice syllogism, and you can make it an argument, and you can debate the strength of the premises. And so that would be kind of like a basic argument against the existence of any kind of supernatural being. And so that would apply to the non-existence of any type of God. So if we're talking about atheism with respect to the most general, unspecified type of God, that's probably the most compelling argument for me. If you talk about a really specific God, like an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good God, then the classical argument from evil is pretty compelling. I don't know whether or not the logical argument from evil works, but the evidential argument from evil is pretty strong, I think. But really, I think my opinions on all these arguments is going to change over time. It has already just in the last year or so. As I investigate these arguments more and read them in more depth, my opinion is going to change completely. And the same is true of my opinion of the theistic arguments. My opinion of their varying strengths has changed over time and will almost certainly continue to do so. But anyway, I've ranted long enough. Thanks for your excellent questions. Just fine, thanks.
Hey, Lou. This is DG Sinclair from 2or3.net. And this has to do with Alvin Plantinga. I would like an overview of his work. Specifically, I know that you mentioned in detail to me kind of like his four major contributions to philosophy. There's another thing you talked about. You talked about his Warren Trilogy, and I would love an overview of the Warren Trilogy. And also, you talked about another one of his popular books, Something, Freedom, and Evil. And I wish you would kind of give an introduction to that.
All right. The audio quality on that was pretty bad. That's as well as I could clean it up. I know Daniel was calling from his car, so that's probably not a good idea when you're leaving these messages. But basically, Daniel was just asking for an overview of the work of Alvin Plantinga. And that's a great idea because if you want to understand contemporary philosophy of religion, you have to understand Alvin Plantinga. He's the number one person that you have to understand. His work has shaped the debate on a lot of the major issues in philosophy of religion, and sometimes I feel like half of the papers that I read in philosophy of religion journals are in some way responding to Plantinga or extending his work. So, who the hell is Alvin Plantinga? Alvin Plantinga is a Calvinist Protestant Christian who, you know, went to school and got a PhD and became a philosopher. The important context here is that in the first half of the 20th century, philosophy of religion really wasn't considered a serious topic of discussion in Western analytic philosophy. One of the major movements in philosophy at the time was called logical positivism, and that was based on the idea that in order for something to be meaningful, there had to be some way to verify it. And so the logical positivists just kind of threw out huge portions of philosophy and said, these aren't even things you can discuss. So metaphysics and philosophy of religion and all kinds of things just weren't even discussed as serious subjects of philosophy. Now, the other major school of philosophical thought in vogue at the time was Wittgensteinian ordinary language philosophy, which didn't have any more room than logical positivism for talking about God in meaningful ways. To Wittgensteinians, talking about God is just some kind of language game that we play and doesn't necessarily refer to anything meaningful in the real world. So philosophers had kind of given up on philosophy of religion. That's a slight overstatement, but only a slight one. Then, in 1955, atheist philosopher J.L. Mackey published Evil and Omnipotence, which was kind of another blow of just the strongest ever formulation of the problem of evil, showing that there's no way that an all-good, all-powerful, all-good God could exist. And this was also reflected in the larger culture. You might remember the 1966 Time magazine cover that just has nothing on it except the words, "Is God dead?" And it was kind of pronouncing the death of God in intellectual circles. And you could see why they would have that cover. Now, the next year, in 1967, Alvin Plantinga published God and Other Minds, which is usually cited as the most important book for reviving philosophy of religion after logical positivism and ordinary language philosophy. And in that book, Plantinga actually goes through the normal theistic arguments, the cosmological argument, the ontological argument, the teleological argument, and argues that they don't really work. So you might not expect that from a theistic philosopher, but in God and Other Minds, he doesn't have a very high opinion of those arguments for the existence of God. And then he moves on and he talks about the problem of evil, and he starts developing this free will defense idea, which I'll talk about later. But then, more importantly, he makes some remarks against this verificationism of the logical positivists, and other people like Quine had already published important work that really attacked logical positivism and kicked off its decline. Plantinga added a few important notes there against the logical positivists. And then in the third part of God and Other Minds, he starts talking about this analogy between our belief that other minds exist as being similar to our belief in God. So if you want to be philosophically rigorous, it's actually surprisingly difficult to demonstrate that other minds exist. And I won't go into the details of that, but you can look it up, the problem of other minds. And so Plantinga says, well, look, there's no good argument for the existence of other minds, and there's not really any good evidence for the existence of other minds, and yet we all believe that we're rational to believe in other minds. And so if we're rational to believe in other minds without good argument or evidence, why can't we be rational to believe in God without argument or evidence? And so that's kind of his parity argument. There's a parity between belief in other minds and belief in God. Now, in the 1970s, he begins to develop some ideas centered around possible worlds and what's called modal logic and necessity and possibility, building on the work of other philosophers like David Lewis. And so in a 1974 book, The Nature of Necessity, he develops this language for talking about possible worlds. And then he applies all this new philosophical apparatus to traditional problems in philosophy of religion. So that's when he applies these modal logic tools to a kind of ontological argument that Norman Malcolm had pioneered earlier, and he put forth this new ontological argument, which a lot of people thought was the best ever version of the ontological argument for the existence of God yet proposed. And then he starts putting this modal logic and possible worlds logic into building up a stronger version, a more precise version of his free will defense against the problem of evil. Now, Plantinga's free will defense was a response specifically to Mackey's 1955 article that argued that the existence of an all-good, all-powerful God is logically incompatible with the existence of evil. So if such an argument was successful, it would kind of be a death knell against theism, right? Because these two things would be logically incompatible, and obviously evil exists, so the conclusion would be, therefore, God can't exist. Now, to claim that something is logically impossible is a very, very strong claim. And so if Plantinga or anyone else can even show that it's logically possible that those two things coexist, then they've defeated the logical problem of evil. And what Plantinga came up with is this idea that it's at least logically possible that God is justified in allowing evil if he has good reasons to allow it. That is, if he's enabling some kind of greater good by allowing this suffering. And Plantinga says it's logically possible that God is allowing this kind of suffering because he has to in order for there to be free will. It might be the case that even an omnipotent God couldn't create a world such that everyone makes free choices but never makes choices that cause suffering. And so, you know, that might not sound like an omnipotent God then, right? Because an omnipotent God's supposed to be able to do anything. But Plantinga has some very specific and subtle arguments that have convinced a lot of people, including some atheists, that it's at least logically possible that even an omnipotent God could create a world in which beings with free will would never cause suffering. So that's the free will defense against the problem of evil. Now, Plantinga very specifically says he doesn't necessarily believe that that's the way things are, right? That would be a theodicy if you're proposing the reason why God does allow suffering. That's not what Plantinga is offering. Plantinga is only offering a possible, a logically possible reason why God would allow suffering. And so that's enough to defeat Mackey's logical problem of evil. Now, because Plantinga's free will defense is so technical and so difficult, and so many people misunderstood it for even like a decade or two after he wrote it, there's still a lot of debate about it. And some theists and some atheists aren't convinced that the logical problem of evil is defeated by Plantinga's free will defense. And in fact, in 2009, Richard Ott, whom I interviewed earlier, actually found a problem in the original 1974 version of the free will defense that Plantinga admitted was a problem and then promptly corrected. So if there's a problem with the argument that's been sitting around for 30 years, and it's the most discussed argument in the philosophy of religion, then there might still be some kinks to work out in it. So I'm not really sure whether or not Plantinga's free will defense actually defeats the logical problem of evil. I'd say it's still an open question, and people are still writing papers about it, finding new things to say about it. So that's Plantinga's free will defense. That's, I mean, there have been 200, 300 papers written on that thing. I'm compiling a bibliography now. It's just endless. Now, in the late 1970s, Plantinga wrote some articles saying a bit more about how he thinks that belief in God could be properly basic. And the idea is there that, according to foundationalism, we are justified in carrying the beliefs that we have only if they are incorrigible, or, you know, they couldn't possibly be false, or if they are properly inferred from beliefs that couldn't possibly be false. And so these beliefs that couldn't possibly be false are properly basic. And so Plantinga wants to argue that in some way, for the Christian at least, belief in God is properly basic. And so it doesn't have to be inferred from evidence, or you don't have to give an argument for the existence of God. You can just say that he's a properly basic belief and that's it. And, you know, the obvious objection to that is, well, why can't you just say that you have a properly basic belief in anything you please? And then, you know, you could have a properly basic belief in the Great Pumpkin. And then you'd have, you know, a basic belief in the Great Pumpkin, and you wouldn't be able to say, well, oh, you don't have arguments or evidence for the Great Pumpkin, because, well, guess what? It's a properly basic belief. So there's a lot of discussion back and forth about that. You can just Google Great Pumpkin Objection. Now, a little bit surprisingly, in the early 90s, Plantinga actually argued against his earlier position of kind of an internalist account of justification and started proposing an externalist account of justification for belief in God. And if you want to know more about internalism and externalism, listen to my interview with Eric Baldwin. You can find it on commonsenseatheism.com. But anyway, so in 1993, Plantinga writes, "Warrant the Current Debate." And this was kind of an overview of a lot of the major theories of knowledge out there and picking out the weaknesses in them. And there are weaknesses in them, which is why all philosophers aren't agreed on one particular theory of knowledge, right? And so Plantinga goes through and kind of surveys all the weaknesses in these theories of knowledge. And then in the second book, Warrant and Proper Function, he starts developing his own theory of what it means to have a true belief that is also justified, or in his terminology, warranted. So the idea is a belief is warranted if it comes from a mental faculty that has been designed to consistently produce true beliefs, functioning in an environment that is conducive to it producing true beliefs. And so that's his account of what it means for a belief to be warranted. Now, in the third book, then, he applies this new theory of knowledge to Christian belief and explains how Christian belief could be warranted given this new theory of warrant in general. And from here he draws on Calvin and says, well, maybe we all have a sensus divinitatis, a sense of God, and this mental faculty is designed to detect God and to form true beliefs about God. And so as long as that sense is operating in an environment conducive to the formation of true beliefs according to its design, then it could be the case that Christians have true beliefs about God by way of this sensus divinitatis. And so that's the whole idea behind Warranted Christian Belief, which was released in the year 2000. And so it's fairly new, but already there's been a lot of discussion on it, several books and dozens of articles. A couple other lesser things that Plantinga has done. Plantinga has written some not just on the logical problem of evil, but also on the probabilistic problem of evil. Another thing he's well known for is the evolutionary argument against naturalism. And how that goes is Plantinga, you know, instead of giving a defense of theism, which is what he's mostly been doing, this is one of his attacks on the rival worldview of naturalism. And so Plantinga says that naturalism doesn't have a good account of how we could have knowledge if naturalism is true. So basically, if our mental faculties evolved by Darwinian means, then Plantinga says there's not any particular reason why we should trust that our mental faculties would be giving true beliefs, because there isn't any reason to see why evolution would select for true beliefs. And so there's been a lot of debate about that, including a book in which 11 philosophers respond to the evolutionary argument against naturalism, and then Plantinga writes the final chapter where he responds to his critics. So those are some of the basic ideas in Plantinga, and unfortunately, unlike William Lane Craig or somebody like that, Plantinga's ideas are pretty subtle and complex, more like maybe Richard Swinburne. And so there's no way for me to really summarize his ideas. You really would have to read it and work your way through the logic very carefully in order to keep up with what he's saying. And the best way to do that, if you want to do that, is to pick up his 1977 book, God, Freedom, and Evil. This is a really small book. You know, it looks like a pamphlet almost. But it's just his ideas on the free will defense against the problem of evil. And then he ends with some thoughts about the ontological argument and stuff. But in that book, he just gives a very clear step-by-step, walks you through every step of the logic in his free will defense, and shows why the logical argument from evil fails. So that's probably the best place to start with Plantinga. So I hope that helps, Daniel, as an introduction to Alvin Plantinga. Thanks for your question.
Hey, Luke, this is D.G. Sinclair from 203.net, abusing your calling line with lots of questions. And my question right now has to do with desireism. And I want to understand if desireism can help us lead, can help us discover at least major objective moral truths, what objective moral truths can be lifted or created from desireism? In other words, if desireism can help us elucidate objective moral truths, please give me the top 10 or the 10 commandments according to desireism. For instance, you shall have no gods before me, something like that.
Right, so what is desireism? Desireism is a theory about morality. It's a theory about what moral terms mean and what moral value is, and as a result of those things, what we morally ought to do in life. Now, I won't try to explain the theory here. I've done 2 podcasts in the past on that subject. Go listen to the episodes with Alonzo Fife, and there's a bunch of posts on my blog as well. Just click on the ethics category in the sidebar. Instead, I'll just respond directly to your question, Daniel, about what are the top 10 commandments that can be derived from desireism. To be honest, I really don't know the answer. As I've been saying, I really am still trying to work through the foundations of the theory and see if they're true, first of all, and see if they're coherent, and see if I really agree with the theory. Right now, I think it's a pretty plausible theory of morality, and so I'm kind of going with it and putting it out there to see what criticisms people bring up. Almost all of the criticisms just simply misunderstand the theory, which is fine, because I totally misunderstood the theory for a couple months after I came across it, and I still, every now and then, will find out something that I misunderstand about it. So it's not difficult to misunderstand. But what I'm trying to say is that I'm not very confident that desireism is actually true. It's just the most plausible theory that I've come across so far, and so I'd like to see it developed and criticized and defended, and so that's what I'm doing. And maybe 30 years from now, I'll be still more or less a desirist, or maybe I'll have a completely different moral theory that I think is plausible. Or, of course, I could very well think that moral values don't exist a couple decades from now. That was my position 2 years ago. But anyway, Daniel, you asked about applied ethics. What moral oughts can we derive from the theory of desireism? And it's a hard question for me to answer because I'm so involved in the theory. That's why I have Alonzo Fife write a regular column on my blog talking about issues in applied ethics, because I don't have time to try to figure out getting from the theory to application. I'm just struggling to keep up with the theory. So here I really just have to defer to Alonzo Fife, who has been working on the theory for many, many years. There is no Ten Commandments, of course, because desireism is not a moral theory that came from a people using a decimal number system. So there's no, you know, Ten Commandments. If I had to guess at what some of the most important moral deliverances of desireism might be, one would be this notion of securing one's beliefs. False beliefs cause a lot of damage, because we can be acting on good desires, but then if our beliefs are false, we might actually cause tremendous damage. And so being careful about forming one's beliefs tends to be pretty important, according to Alonzo Fife, in desireist theory. Alonzo has also argued that free speech tends to be important according to desireism, meaning that people should be free to say what they want without threats of violence. Doesn't mean that you can't be criticized for what you say, it just means that you shouldn't be threatened with violence for what you say. Environmental issues tend to be pretty important in desireism because the environment has a tendency to massively affect millions of people with desires at the same time. And for the same reason, I would suspect that issues of weapons of mass destruction and nuclear proliferation would be important. Those are some issues. You can read more about that in Alonzo's posts on my blog, and especially Alonzo's blog, atheistethicist.blogspot.com. So I'm sure that's very dissatisfying to you, but again, I'm really working on the moral theory, and I haven't had time to try to derive some applications for applied ethics from the theory of desireism. Okay, next question.
Hi, Luke. This is Mark, and I'm a new reader of your blog. I wanted to ask you for your thoughts on a question which is fairly painful to me as an atheist, which is the whole issue of dogmatism coming from within the atheist blogosphere. Specifically, I see a lot of prominent atheist bloggers or atheist blog commenters were eager to mock and dismiss out of hand some fairly sophisticated philosophical arguments that they clearly don't understand very well, but whose conclusions they find threatening somehow. I guess I'm thinking here of things like P.Z. Meyer's response to planting his evolutionary argument against naturalism, or more recently to the whole fiasco surrounding Fodor's critique of adaptationist explanation in biology. Although I do think these arguments ultimately have good and sophisticated refutation, I'm kind of bothered by the atheist blogosphere's collective reaction.
So my question is, what are we supposed to do about the fact that, as committed as our community is to reason, so many of us end up so dogmatic?
Excellent. This is a question that is near and dear to my heart, and it's right in line with a really major thrust of everything that I write on commonsenseatheism.com, because I want atheists and free thinkers to realize that we do not have a monopoly on rationality or critical thinking or even science some of the time. The inability to use critical thinking and the tendency towards a number of really serious cognitive biases is not about being religious. It's about being human. Dogmatism is a human condition, not a religious condition. And it's very obvious to see this happening. Mark, you gave some excellent examples of atheists who will dismiss an argument before they even understand it. And that happens all the time from both sides. It's part of what another blogger, ex-apologist, calls modus tollensing your belief. So modus tollens is a form of argument, and this is how it would work to reinforce your own beliefs. Premise one, if argument such and such were successful, that would mean that God exists. Premise two, but God does not exist. Therefore, conclusion, argument is not successful. And that's how we think a lot of the time. It's very human, very natural, and very, very hard to train yourself out of. I spend a lot of time very specifically and consciously training myself to not do that kind of thing, to reject all forms of dogmatism. And it's just ineradicable. It's part of the human condition, and it's really hard to fight, even when you're trying. And when you're not trying, then, yeah, you're falling prey to it all the time. So I think you're right on the money, Mark. This is a big problem, and I think religion will kind of fade away and become irrelevant long before critical thinking becomes the norm. In other words, it won't be critical thinking that is the death knell of religion. It'll be, you know, it becomes irrelevant to people's lives, or it just doesn't seem like a very moral position anymore to be religious, or it's just totally unnecessary. Those will be the reasons why religion dies out. It won't be because most people are thinking critically or logically, unless we somehow modify the brain such that it acts more logically, but that's science fiction right now. Now, some religious people, for example Christians, are especially vulnerable to their cognitive biases because their religion affirms them. I mean, religion, you get people like Alvin Plantinga, off the charts brilliant, spending thousands of pages just to justify his own feelings that he doesn't want to give up. And so a lot of religions will do that, where they say, you know, put your mystical experiences above all else, and just don't pay attention to the fact that lots of other people have mystical experiences and they're not reliable. So that's one way to really, really pump up the effectiveness of our cognitive biases and destroy critical thinking. But atheism has its own way of destroying critical thinking, and that's to say, we know we're on the good ground here. We know we're the rational ones and we're the critical thinkers. And I think that, too, can really cause a problem, because then people feel like, well, we're the critical thinkers. Even if I don't do all the research, there's, you know, atheist philosophers and scientists who have done all the critical thinking about these issues, and I know that our conclusion is the rational one because it's the free-thinking one. It's the one that the scientists and the philosophers agree with, right? But that's a real, real danger, because then you're not taking critical thinking seriously. And so the most important position to take on this type of issue is to tell yourself, remind yourself every day that you're a human being and your brain evolved lots of cognitive biases, and you're really going to have to work if you want to actually think critically about everything that comes through your mind. And obviously, you don't have time to critically process everything, but when you're presented with an argument, don't assume that the argument works or doesn't work. Just look at the argument. And another really important stance or position in all of this is to be okay with whatever the truth is. If the truth means that objective moral value doesn't exist, you have to be okay with that, or else your cognitive biases are going to flare up and they're really going to make it difficult for you to get at the truth of the matter. If you are really reluctant to give up the idea of ultimate purpose or objective meaning or intrinsic value or something like that, your cognitive biases are quite happy to come in there and defend the dogma. And it's really hard for critical thinking to even get off the ground. So a really important thing is to emotionally work on yourself to be okay emotionally with whatever the truth happens to be. And that'll make it easier for you to apply critical thinking evenly and fairly to every issue that you decide to spend your time thinking through. And the other thing, of course, is just to train yourself. I mean, there are lots and lots of really good logic books out there. There are lots of critical thinking books. It really is a practice. And it can be fun. I mean, it's really important, actually, that you make critical thinking fun, because if it's not fun, you'll never do it. And so one way that I do this is, well, Jon Stewart, The Daily Show, is a great introduction to critical thinking, because he will look at news stories and he'll compare and contrast what people said on day one and day two and look for fallacies and all this kind of stuff, and it's very entertaining. And you can do the same thing in your mind. You can make a joke out of it, make a satire out of it, say, you know, well, wait a second, look at this premise. It looks like it entails something that's contradictory to the conclusion or whatever. And you can really have a lot of fun with critical thinking. So those are some tips that I would say might be helpful for individuals trying to develop their critical thinking skills and immunize themselves from dogmatism. But how do we do it in the world at large? And I think this comes back to praise and condemnation. People's desires are shaped by praise and condemnation. We got half the world to give up the thousands of years practice of slavery in just a couple generations with praise and condemnation. It didn't happen because of the law. It's not like we're walking around saying, gosh, I wish it wasn't illegal to own slaves. No, our desires changed. We actually would find it emotionally repulsive to own a slave. And that changed in just a couple generations after thousands of years of standard practice because of praise for people who promoted equal rights and condemnation for those who felt like it was okay to own slaves. And so we can do the same thing with the desires that have to do with critical thinking. We can condemn those who are reckless with their beliefs. We can condemn those who just don't have any desire to challenge their own beliefs. We can condemn those who allow their cognitive biases to rule their lives. And we can praise those who overcome their cognitive biases. We can praise those people who work really hard to care about whether or not their beliefs are true. We can praise those people who are willing to give up comfort and money and sometimes even a job in order to think through something critically. And that'll start to make a difference. But you've got to start with yourself. You've always got to start with yourself. So with yourself, I would say make critical thinking fun. Make it a normal part of your cognitive process throughout the day. Learn critical thinking, obviously. You have to study just a bit of logic and critical thinking. And then get yourself to an emotionally healthy place where you're okay if what you like turns out not to be true. Get yourself to an emotionally healthy place where it's okay if the things that you want to be true aren't true, or that things you don't want to be true would be true. You've got to be okay with the truth, or else your cognitive biases are going to quite happily overwhelm your attempts at critical thinking. All right, well, I could talk all day about that because it's a really, really important issue to me. And I thank you, Mark, for bringing it up. We have a common passion about this issue of dogmatism. Dogmatism and cognitive bias is a human condition, not a religious condition. Okay, that's it. If you'd like to leave your own message and get a response, just call 413-723-0175 and leave a message. It's really easy. In fact, just do it right now. Call 413-723-0175 and leave a message, and I'll respond in a later episode. Thanks for all your great questions. I look forward to speaking with you again.